Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. I'm really pumped to share this episode. I'm speaking with Neil Howe, author of The Fourth Turning Is Here, What the Seasons of History Tell Us About How and When This Crisis Will End. Back in the 1990s, Neil, along with his departed colleague, William Strauss, wrote The Fourth Turning, which made the provocative argument that modern life moves in generational historical cycles, what they call turnings. Despite the peace and prosperity of the 90s, they predicted that after 2008, we'd enter a crisis period or a fourth turning, a prediction that nearly perfectly rhymes with many of the challenges we face today. Now, Neil argues that many of the themes and topics we cover on this show, from geopolitics and great power conflict to party realignments and civil strife at home, contribute to what he and William Strauss predicted back in 1997. So many different topics are going to be hit here. The thing I noticed that whether or not you agree with Neil and William's theories or predictions, we should understand that so much of their approach is shaped by where we live today. They were actually the ones who came up with the term millennium, so their thoughts on generational change are incredibly important. I cannot recommend this and The Fourth Turning enough. Such enjoyable books that provide a lot of value and frameworks for understanding of the world. So I hope you all enjoy this conversation and that I can make this comprehensible. Huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the podcast work. Hope you all enjoy this conversation. Neil Howe, welcome to The Realignment.
Well, thank you very much, Marshall, for having me on your show.
Yeah, I'm excited to speak with you. Obviously, at a pure sociological level, you're the person, along with your departed co-author, William Strauss, that came up with the term millennial. So it's interesting to interview you as a millennial. So much of my self-conception is literally stemming from the words and concepts that you're really talking about here. So here's what I want to just start with. This is such an interesting book for me, this being The Fourth Turning Is Here, because I'm not just interviewing you, this person who has this theory of the world, who is putting it out there. This is a follow-up to a book from the 1990s, The Fourth Turning, where you made some predictions about how the next 25, 30 years would go, predictions that in many ways rhyme with a lot of the, let's say, diagnosis one would give of the challenges facing America and the world in the 2020s. So I just want to start here. 1990s, we know the cliches. It's the end of history. I've interviewed Francis Fukuyama on this podcast. What did you see in the 1990s that in 1997 would convince you, hey, I should maybe write a book that suggests that this isn't going to go as long as one thinks it will, or things aren't as strong at a foundational level as one would think, given the way we tend to reinterpret how we think about that moment today?
Yeah, that was, so Bill and I decided to write this book, I don't know, probably, 1995, 1996. There wasn't anything we were seeing in the 1990s. And of course, that's the whole point. We're trying to look ahead to something that wasn't seen yet. I mean, looking at history to be able to understand the future is an exercise in being able to look around corners. See how things will change. I mean, anyone can extrapolate. I mean, if anything, the future is always going to be, the last 10 or 20 years extrapolated forward, then you don't really need history, do you? You just don't need it. You need to go deeply into the past. And this is, I think in the book, quote Churchill to this effect, the deeper into the past you go and the more deeply you understand history, the better you're able to see around the corners. And in fact, we had already written a book, Generations, which came out in 1991. We wrote that in the late 1980s, which already sort of made the prediction. I mean, we already had the basic dynamics of the rhythm of history in place that was generationally driven, right? That suggested that, this period of, the autumn season, what we call the unraveling era, would end sometime in the 2000-2010 decade, sometime in the middle of that decade. And in fact, I think it ultimately did with the GFC, the global financial crisis. But we had already seen that, right? So it wasn't suddenly a discovery. It was, now I think you could say that there were certain people in the late 1990s. There was a famous debate, for instance, between Francis Fukuyama and Sam Huntington, who had a kind of a different view of where the future was going to go. In other words, there were differences of opinion on this.
And that debate you're referencing is the clash of civilizations, kind of thing. Exactly. That's an alternate model.
Exactly. And, but I think it's fair to say that a number of people were thinking, you know, a very lightly governed America where seemingly individualism was rampant and the marketplace had triumphed and globalism was everywhere and governmental intervention and regulation seemed to be disappearing. And it was the end of all big issues, you know, the end of all strong governmental actions, the end of all strong historical conflicts was coming about. I think a lot of people could sense that probably wasn't going to happen, right? That seemed a little too good to be true. It's a little bit like, you know, after a long, long summer and a long, long fall, you think, even if you're not thinking back to the last winter, you're kind of wondering, is this going to, you know, keep going? And I think there were a lot of Americans at the time who had trepidations about how long this would last. All we did simply said, there actually is a timetable. It does come to an end. And that there are these rhythms of history. There are these eras which are generationally driven, and you can anticipate when they will begin and end to some extent. And that was really our method, as you know. And so it wasn't looking at what was happening at the time, but it was looking simply at the calendar.
So the helpful follow-up here then, you describe the period we're in as a fourth turning. We'll get to like the exact definition of a turning, but to make this comprehensible to people, we should understand this is the millennial crisis. That's what you're referring to this current moment as. I'd love for you to just define what you see as the crisis in American / global society today. And how does that articulation of the crisis fit within the model you provided in 1997? Where are the gaps? Where does the timeline intersect helpfully? Wherever you want to take it.
Well, maybe it's best to go and actually look at what turnings are and how we arrived at this. Bill and I, when we first started writing, did not have any particular theory of cyclical history at all. We originally wanted to write a book simply about different generations in American history and what kind, you know, how they're different, why they're different, and why they leave such different legacies. You know, we had been members of the boomer generation, which was very famously different. You might even say almost archetypally the opposite of our parents' generation who fought World War II. And there were just such absolutely dramatic differences. You know, the GI generation was protectively raised. We were indulgently raised. They came of age with D-Day. We came of age with Woodstock. They spent their young adult years building battleships and founding families, and we were sort of taking voyages inside ourselves. It was a completely different kind of experience. And we wanted to know, had these incredible generational contrasts, which, you know, certainly boomers were very well aware of, happened before in American history. And we found that they had. And in fact, going all the way back to the early 17th century, we really started with the first old world immigrants to New England in the 1630s, the Great Migration to New England, the Puritan generation. We found that had a very strong generational sense. They were different from their kids, different from their parents. And this is not new. This didn't just start with boomers or Gen X or millennials, right? This had been with us since the founding of America, you know.
And one quick thing, what's fascinating about the cyclical nature of this, it's not simply just that I am different than my father. It's that my differences with my father are a lot like the differences between his father and his grandfather in terms of like this, there's the repeating nature to that.
Yeah, there is a repeating nature because what we found was that not only are generations very different, these generations tended to follow a recurring pattern. That is to say, following, for example, a very idealistic and anti-establishment generation like boomers, you know, we're all familiar with the fact that you had these very kind of caustic, cynical, pragmatic generation of Xers, right? Who are just survivalists, you know, raised to think for themselves and really, you know, die yuppie scum, really couldn't, you know, stand boomers, you know, coming of age, a very different sense of themselves. We found that that had been repeated constantly in American history. You know, following the Transcendentals, you had the Gilded Generation of people like Ulysses Grant, a completely different generation of metal and muscle, just very different kind of sense of themselves. And but this goes back to the Americans' founding. And you can find other differences too. For example, the generations that come of age during the great crises of American history, like the American Revolution, the Civil War, you know, the Great Depression and World War II, tend to be very community-oriented generations from the get-go, you know, from the time they were raised as children, right? And they have a much more strong sense of their collective strength and a much more, and are looking much more for an ordered view of society in the future.
And can I pause you? Can I pause you there real quick to understand this? As a millennial, I do not feel as if my generation feels, to speak for all of us here with the, you know, voice of God as a podcaster, I do not think we feel community oriented. And I think you could go through all the statistics we all know, loneliness, disengagement, all the Robert Putnam-y things. So is your argument that the crisis itself, and the crisis is an era, right? It isn't 2008. It's, this is why it's useful to think of the Great Depression period was the 1930s all the way through World War II. Does the crisis forge us into community-oriented people by the nature of what we have to do? Or is there some community-oriented, order-seeking aspect of my personality that is buried and has to be brought out through that moment? How should we understand that?
I think the latter. So a lot of the FOMO and the loneliness and all that, which you're absolutely right, is because millennials seek community but can't find it. We know, for instance, that in grade school, you know, they're more likely to do community service. They like the idea of community service. I remember all the millennials. You remember when, I can't remember, you know, what John McCain's running mate, you remember, ran, up in Alaska, you know, ran, I remember her convention speech, nominating convention speech, but she constantly put down community service. And I had a bunch of millennial employees, and they were cracking with tears the next morning. You know, what's the matter with community service? How can you possibly fault people for wanting to bring the community together? In other words, millennials feel that they are in a Hunger Games world, you know, or a Squid Game, you know what I mean? That kind of world where they don't want to be. They want this community. We see it in so many aspects of millennial life. They want to work for big employers and want to work for employers with benefits. They want to work for employers that bring them together as a community. You see them living together in cities. You see them actually increasingly being marketed, you know, these sort of communal units where everyone shares stuff together. The whole advent of the sharing economy. This was exactly the opposite of boomers in the same phase of life. Boomers didn't want to live with their parents. They want to do anything possible to live away from their parents, right? And they certainly didn't want to live with each other in general. Right. They wanted strong locks on their door, and they all wanted an individual play. But my sense is that millennials feel they're in a world which is not theirs. They need to transform it in the community direction, right? There's no question that this is not a community world today. But that's the sense. Ortega Gasset once said that every generation is a trajectory. It's not a place. It's a sense of where it's going, where it wants to go. Boomers have changed America since the time they were growing up as Leave It to Beavers in a very corporate, organized, community-oriented America into this totally individualized place. I mean, just think of the boomer arc as they have taken over society, sort of blasting everything into little bits and pieces of atoms, you know, until now we have, you know, we don't have defined benefit pensions. We have defined contribution, but you can contribute if you want to. And if you don't, you can always roll it over. You can borrow from it. You can do anything you want. Boomers have turned out to be, over their life cycle, extremely tolerant of huge divisions of differences in income in America today, big differences in class. Because you remember, the biggest problem when they were coming of age was America's oppressive and overwhelming middle class. Back in the late 1960s, the Gini coefficient for income and wealth approached its all-time low, right? We were a very tightly bound society at that point. Boomers hated it. It was Pleasant Valley Sunday, charcoal burning everywhere. Everyone was identical. How can we have different strokes for different folks? Go different directions. And pretty soon, it wasn't started with the culture on college campuses and even inner cities resisting, you know, authority and the patriarchy and so on, and then we're telling you what to do. But it ended up by the late 70s, early 80s in the economy, you know, tax cuts, deregulation. And so that whole panoply, both on the left and the right with boomers, was all around liberating individuals from all the social discipline and constraint, right? And ultimately leading us into the autumn season. I talk about the awakening as the summer season, right? That's the summer of the saculum. But the autumn season is this period of weak and disempowered institutions, but strong individualism. In the boomer era, Marshall, you go into a bookstore and all the most upbeat books are about me, myself, and I. You ever notice that? I can do anything. I can triumph. All of the most downbeat books are about what we have in common: death of the family, death of politics. And that is the world that boomers have created. There is a seasonal arc to these things. And I think that comes clear in our writing. And it's not just this saculum. You can see the same things in prior saculum. You see the same things happening as when we went into the 1850s before the Civil War. You can see the same thing happening as you go into the 1760s before the American Revolution. And my point again is that it's only by getting deeply involved in history that you can appreciate and begin to sense these longer term rhythms. And a lot of the book has to do with tracing social indicators. And you recall, I mean, you've read the book, you know, we trace, you know, we look at Robert Putnam's, you know, work, you know, we look at the indicators of community. We look at indicators of the realignment cycle in politics, right? We look at foreign policy. We look at demographics, you know, fertility and immigration. We look at culture. We look at religion. Religion is an interesting aspect of American life that most historians don't really take very seriously. We took it very seriously. And the history of America is not just the history of economies, politics, and civic achievements. It's also the history of the inner life, culture, religion, how we think about ourselves from the inside out. And if I were simply to say, when you map the four turnings along the saculum lasts about 80 to 100 years, right? And it's divided into generation length pieces. And each of those pieces is a season, right? And in the second turning is a solstice. You know, the sun gets its longest length days. That's the awakening. And that's when society remakes its inner world of values, religion, culture. The winter season is the opposite solstice. That's when the sun is in its lowest. And that's when we remake the outer world of political institutions, infrastructure, economics, how we actually live together in the material world. How do we actually create real communities outside ourselves, right? So there is a yin and yang quality to it. And the kinds of generations coming of age in these different eras are very different. One is what we call the prophet archetype, like boomers. We're like the missionary generation born after the Civil War. the so-called the wise old men and women during the World War II and the New Deal, you know, the likes of
Henry Stimson, you know, those
Stimson and MacArthur and FDR and Einstein and all those. And they were looked up to for values and vision. And the generation coming of age during that period was the GI generation. And they were great technocrats. I mean, there were great community players. And to some extent, you think the GIs, you know, when we look at the GI generation, which has been sort of
Could you give like initial birth date for the GI? Because like
The GI generation would be born in 1901 to 1924. And the one who really saw combat the most was sort of the later half of that generation. But there were
JFK is a good archetype.
Yeah, JFK to George Bush Sr., right? Who was one of the youngest members of that generation, you know, very, very young as a fighter pilot when he got shut down. But my point is that that generation, we look at them and Tom Brokaw wrote the book, you know, The Greatest Generation. We look back at them and you think, oh my gosh, they were always, you know, this way. They stood at the very beginning for country and so on. They were always as American as apple pie, right? What we forget is that they were kids brought up and they believed in community, much as millennials do today as aspirational. I mean, they were the ones who were raised to, join the 4-H clubs, and they were the first Girl Scouts and Boy Scouts that were raised in school uniforms for the first time. People wanted to protect these kids, much as people wanted to protect millennials when they first came along, right? And they wanted to see them more in civic life, much as the way Bill Clinton said it was a great idea back in the mid-1990s that millennials would be in school uniforms. You remember the old school uniform movement? And they came of age at a time when they really believed in sort of community would be great for America's future. And they looked up, and the generations above them were very individualist. And the next generation older was the lost generation. They were the rum runners and the gin fizz crowd during the 1920s. Mm-hmm. They were wild, you know, wild partiers and hated authority, hated government, and generally voted for the Republican Party, by the way. GIs came of age voting for the Democratic Party. But of course, at that point, the economy gave way,
mm-hmm.
right? We have the great, you know, Black Thursday, the economy went into a free fall. And one thing we forget is a lot of the millennial generation joined the Communist Party. I mean, they became socialists. They became anti-American. I mean, they became the opposite of what we remember. Many of them swore to the destruction of capitalism in the United States. And sometimes people ask me, you know, are these millennials, you know, you call them a hero archetype, but many of them are so anti-American and so on. I said, do you ever look at the GI generation when they were that age, right?
Think of the original, neoconservatives at, you know, City College of New York. Irving Kristol, a lot of these figures were
all of them.
Were in the 1930s, and the point you're getting
they
at
were
too,
they were Trotskyists. I mean,
yeah,
they were in the Trotsky fringe. Of course, they backed the losing candidate of that one, but yes, now they were admittedly, there were still socialists after World War II was over, which kind of distinguishes them from a lot of, you know, their fellow travelers who really fell back in line more during the war. And obviously, you know, Stalin really discredited himself with the Stalin-Hitler pact, and many things brought about sort of the collapse a little bit of the enthusiasm around Comintern. But nonetheless, we forget where that generation started, and we forget how unlikely it seemed that they would be able to create this new America. But to some extent, you're absolutely right. They were transformed by the World War II experience, by the New Deal, and especially by World War II. And by the time the war was over, we were a different country, right?
Yeah, a couple of things.
Yeah, go ahead.
A couple of things. One, I just want to, because this is really a book to be read. I usually listen to Audible books, but I just want to read this book. I'm recommending to listeners that you read the book. It's just very, like, there's concepts and things are floating out. It's really just a book that should be read. So I want to make this very clear. When you were talking about, the individualism versus community orientation, I think listeners should think back to how insane movies like Office Space, American Beauty, Pleasantville look to us now. So those are baby boomer produced 1990s movies where you'd think the worst thing in the world is you live in a suburb, you have a house, and you've got a 40 to 50 hour a week job that is consistent. There's also the theme of Fight Club. You know, the hell at the narrator's life is that he has to go to IKEA and he just can't find the perfect individual. So if you talk to any, especially during the worst parts of, like, let's say COVID or the aftermath, if you talk to any millennial or even, you know, Gen Zer, they'd say, wait, what's Kevin Spacey's problem in American Beauty? This looks pretty great. Like, these are perfect illustrations of how these different perspectives are going to be shaped at a deeply generational level, except from purely politics and those things.
But it's also a sign of how the saeculum keeps turning. One thing I point out, actually, when I get to the last section, I talk about the first turning. I don't know if you recall that chapter, but I sort of say what happened in the last, what happened in the late 40s when we were all kind of tooling down from war and America went into this very different period, right?
And one quick thing, the fourth event in that scenario, because this is a good pivot, so we should tell the last 75 years to this, the fourth turning was obviously Great Depression, World War II. So now after World War II, you're getting into the first turning after
the first turning again, which prioritizes community, de-emphasizes individualism. America, society itself feels that it's more the sum of its part than the sum of its parts, right? Which is the opposite of the fall season when we feel as individuals much more empowered than the community, right? So it's a very different kind of gestation of a very different sense of what society is, right? It always comes after crisis. And I make this point, everyone wants to know, when can we get a golden age again where we all believe in community? We all, we're a band of brothers writ large, that kind of sense, right? I hate to say it, it only happens after crisis. And you look back in American history, in those periods when people thought they were living in something resembling a golden age, only comes after crisis. And there's a reason for that. And I explore that in the book. You might even say the society is scared straight, on a massive scale.
What's your threshold for crisis? Because this is where the definitions get fascinating. Because first, I mean, sure, you remember this.
Well,
active. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, let me just make this observation as a maybe a cautionary note to everyone who's watching. And that is, this is not a prediction. This is just a correlation, right? Every fourth turning that we've ever had going back to the 15th century has always featured a total war. And every total war that we've had has always occurred in a fourth turning. You know what I mean?
So that's the Revolutionary War, Civil War.
Civil War. Yeah. And then going back, the incredible wars we had during the Glorious Revolution, which is America's first kind of revolutionary moment around the time of the Glorious Revolution in London. But it was a period of brutal warfare in the colonies. And then going back before that, back to the Armada, the War of the Roses. I mean, we go back. It's an amazing rhythm. And so what happens in those periods, as you can imagine, now what's the conflict about? Well, it could be a conflict with some exterior community, or it could be a conflict within the community, the Civil War, for example, or the War of the Roses, which is basically two parts of the community splitting into two sections and then having it out, right? One of them has to prevail. Or it's some interesting combination of the two. And as I point out in the book, these aren't either or. It's very often a little bit of both. I often say the American Revolution was a little bit of both. I mean, King George was over there, but on the other hand, most of the killing during the late 1770s and early 1780s was colonists killing other colonists. I mean, it was American.
Especially in the South. You write about this, but in the South,
exactly.
If you're a loyalist in the South, it's not great.
No, it was terrible, and it was the backcountry loyalist against the plantation patriots But anyway, it was horrible violence. And at the time, it was generally referred to as a civil war. People referred to it as a civil war in America. Only later did the Patriots, kind of, because they get to write history, right? The winners get to write history and say, oh, no, it was a revolution against these British. You know, it was all about King George. And we were, you know, it was all about redcoats. And forget the fact that 100,000 colonists exited the colonies in the early 1780s, along with the British. That would have been the equivalent of 7 million Americans today, you can imagine. And that's probably an undercount because, you know, many probably migrated on their own. So anyway, this is my point. We see both of these things today in America, right?
Yes.
We see the growing risk of geopolitical conflict. In fact, we're engaged in a proxy war right now and a major land war in Europe. We fear now near term, we fear something in the Western Pacific. We also fear the increasing threat of the bifurcation and collective conflict of two sides of America, sort of the red zone, blue zone conflict. 10 years ago, we did not even do surveys on civil war in America, the possibility of civil war in America. But at last count, over the last few years, it's been about half of Americans think that it's likely to happen, you know, in the next few years. And this is just people's visceral feeling about what's happening in this country. So my point is that these trends that we predicted long before anyone talked about any of this, we seem to be there. At least people seem to have entered that mind space, right? Where it's at least thinkable today. And what we're saying is, it's not only thinkable, some form of these things is likely to happen. Which will occur? We don't know. And as I point out in the book, the difference between an internal conflict and an external conflict is often on a razor edge, all the way up into the point until society decides which way it's going to go. It was certainly that way in the 1930s. If you had asked people in the 1937, you know, what kind of, if there's going to be a big conflict in this country, what would it be? They probably would have said, well, it would have been the New Deal against its opponents. I mean, we were incredibly polarized.
Roosevelt's a dictator, all of the.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, it was going to be a revolution. In fact, we had Sinclair Lewis came out with a book, It Can't Happen Here, which is all about a fascist takeover in America. In other words, we thought that would be the conflict. But in a process, and I spell out in the book, which has to do with what kind of a second regeneracy that often occurs during a crisis era, the country galvanized around a different set of issues. And it was sort of an interesting sectional game because it had to do with Roosevelt jettisoning some of his northern support and bringing back on board some of his southern Democratic supporters that he needed, because of course they dominated all the leadership of all the congressional parties because of seniority, right? So he brought them back on board and he galvanized the country around essentially an us versus fascism agenda. And ultimately, the attack on Pearl Harbor was almost anticlimactic. This country mobilized for war in the sense
prior
of being the arsenal of democracy about a year earlier. About really even at the end of 1940, and we really started pumping up the fiscal pumps by the opening months of 1941. So that was almost a year before Pearl Harbor. Story of how that happened. Very hard to predict in advance how that would have gone. What our point is, and my point continuing in this book, is that no, you can't predict which way it will go. What you can predict is that something will go, right? That there will be a conflict, and that conflict will reinstill this new sense of humanity. It's the overall social process can be predicted, not the actual tangibles of the conflict itself.
So we've discussed a bunch of different crises so far in the podcast. And if we just do the quick AP U.S. history summary, Civil War. I mean, the Revolutionary War is about, you know, the nature of what America is in terms of a British colony or independent thing. So war is about a debate around, are we these states united or are we the United States? Union versus secession. Great Depression to World War II is the domestic thing. It's the external thing, but also domestically, the nature of the industrial economy, financial structures, size of government, et cetera, et cetera. What would you say the millennial crisis, this period of roughly 2008 to the present into the future, what is this crisis about?
I think we can tell what kinds of events will get us in there. What we can't predict is how we will be transformed when we come out of it. And I mean that honestly. When we went into the Civil War, remember, the elimination of slavery wasn't even on the table. And I often remind that, Lincoln, in fact, broadly agreed with people that he would sign a constitutional amendment guaranteeing the South slavery indefinitely in the South, so long as, you know, that he was running on the Republicans basically inherited the Free Soil platform and the Free Soil Party. We just didn't want slavery in any of the new territories or states for reasons which were fine with the abolitionists, but they also suited a lot of white people that didn't want any blacks in any of the new territories, slave or not. You know what I mean? So, in other words, it was a mixture of motives. But the abolition of slavery was not on the table when Lincoln was elected at the time when the South seceded. I remind people that because they read back. You know what I mean? They read back. Mm-hmm. They think, oh, well, that was what the nation wanted. We were divided over that. No, that was not on the table. We had no idea that that would eventuate. It was only when we got into total war and Lincoln finally said, given the scale of the casualties, we have to do anything possible to weaken the South. We're going to declare slavery's contraband. And so any slave who wants to come over, they will be freed forever because that will weaken the South. But then, of course, the radical Republicans in Congress were jubilant because they knew that that policy, if the Union won the war, would mean the total eradication of slavery in the South. So in a sense, we adopted the abolition of slavery as a wartime measure. And Lincoln made it very clear that he was not in favor in abstract of abolition of slavery. But he was, because he wanted to break, wanted to make sure that his conservatives, Republicans were on board and his war Democrats wouldn't abandon him.
Keep the border states all.
Yeah, he wanted to keep them in the wars. But, and so time and again, we see that these huge long-term permanent decisions are made in the heat of crisis. And this is a point I bring up. I think it's in The Fourth Turning is a Social Process. I think it's chapter, I don't know, pretty good at remembering these things. I think it's chapter 8. But I talk about social processes. And one of the most amazing and some paradoxical things about our history is that if you ask people, when would be the best time to make huge, permanent, long-term decisions, about changing our constitution or doing everything better again, everyone would sort of say, well, the best time would be when we're all prosperous, happy, we have plenty of resources to spare to make
peace dividend. It's 1993. This is good.
Yeah, 1993, 1997, when the World War turning, it would have been a perfect time. We actually foresaw that we have a balanced budget. The Cold War was over. We had all these extra resources. History says, so in other words, a sunny day, right? Wait for that sunny day and we'll make these long-term decisions. But history says, that may be the rational thing to do, but history says it's absolutely not what we do, actually do. We do the opposite. We wait for the rainy day, the stormy day, when all of our backs are against the wall, where we face with existential decisions about whether our nation and community will last at all. Near-term problems, immediate problems about we're facing defeat in the base. Suddenly we make long-term decisions. It is paradoxical, right? Well, and we do it again and again. We did it with the Constitution. We did it with these enormous decisions in domestic policy during the Civil War, everything from the original Yosemite Grant, from the National Parks, Transcontinental Railroad, and, you know, the regulation of the money supply, income time, I could go through all the things we did. And similarly with the New Deal era in World War II. And so that's paradoxical. But again, it shows that how when people think about the climax of a fourth turning, which I think we are drifting toward, we're in the fourth turning of an era, but we're drifting toward the climax, that we fear it because we know that that's going to be duress. It's going to be painful. It's going to be hardship. And it likely to involve organized conflict. But on the other hand, we should realize that that's nature's way of bringing about a creative destruction of institutional life and rejuvenating who we are as a republic. And we do that periodically in our nation's existence. We sometimes even call these, in fact, it's not hard to find historians and political scientists calling, you know, the first republic after the, you know, the second republic after the Civil War, the third republic after the New Deal. We're headed toward our fourth republic, you know, after the climax of this fourth turning. And it will involve, probably will consummate a decisive realignment politically. Oh, there you go. Right to the name of your show, you know, realignment. But all of that will happen, and we will make long-term decisions, the exact nature of which still, even now, we can only begin to imagine what those might be. I mean, look, we all know what big problems we have, you know, big public policy challenges. I mean, you could talk about all of them from kind of sclerotic, non-competitive economy, which is, you know, failing to really generate the living standard growth and the productivity growth that we once experienced, to things such as climate change, problems such as climate change, the inability to balance the budget, the inability just to tilt the entire playing field of this nation's economy toward the young and toward the future. Instead, it's all tilted to rewarding older people and to consumption. All of those things get resolved at the same time, right? You come out of the fourth turning suddenly with a long-term orientation toward long-term goals. Suddenly, and of course, who represents the future? Who represents the long-term? Kids, young people. So there's a huge emphasis in investing on them, just like we did after World War II. Suddenly passed the GI Bill, and education was free. Higher education, vocational.
Suburbs, Levittowns, you create a new way of living. This gets to a big question that I have, not just as an interviewer, but actually as a reader. You have this concept of these precursor events. And this is a very key thing. So in the middle of these turnings, in the middle of the cycle, you have World War I. That's a precursor.
Well, specifically in the fall season, in the third turning before the fourth turning hits. So these are always third turning events.
And which is also 9/11. 9/11 is another example then.
9/11 was, again, a third turning. You know, it occurred, you know, late in the third turning, not long before the fourth turning started, right?
So what I want to know then is, because this is where we get to the explaining the generational archetypes, hero, millennial, you know, artist, you know, Gen Z, prophets, those are the silent gens. No, right. those are boomers.
But yeah, prophet would be boomer, and the silent generation would be the artist archetype, you know, born in.
So then the way to understand this then, do precursor events not lead to, let's say, a resolution of, because oftentimes the precursor events will presage in many ways the actual crises of like the fourth turning. So World War I, obviously you've got a lot of domestic strife at home, like try being an anti-war progressive during that period. You have, you know, the Red Scare, you've got obviously what the external, what's the world order look like, that very much rhymes with World War II. Same thing of 9/11, generation unity, et cetera. Do they not lead to resolution because the generation in charge does not constitutionally have the ability to conclude it, right? So can Woodrow Wilson not do something that FDR can?
Yeah, every generation lives in the wrong place, right? In other words, there is such a thing as a fourth turning constellation. When you finally get the prophet archetype well into old age, Gen Xers totally in charge of institutions, you know, admirals, generals, CEOs, and so on. The hero archetype, well, you know, totally in control of young adulthood, you know, extending all the way into the mid-40s, right? Mm-hmm. And that's when you have the maximum outer world creative potential, right? Because the doers are young, the community organizers and the people who actually want to do things, the left-brained organization, things about how do we create these big new ordered forms are young. They're actually great things. And the values-oriented people are old, right? So, and then you've got the pragmatic generation in between who just knows how to get stuff done, right? I mean, they sort of break rules, break heads, do whatever you want to make sure it's done. You get the Omar Bradleys and the Dwight Eisenhowers and the George Pattons, right? They're all in that midlife space. So that's the maximum potential for changing the world. On the other hand, think about another set of positions. Let's say you have the profit archetype, young adults. So the vision and values is all among the young. And then you've got the elder generation as the doers, you know, the rationalists, the doers, the people who believe in the community. And then you have sort of a wishy-washy generation between. We'll just call the you know, Michael Dukakis generation of silent, right? That's like maximum dysfunction, right? So you have the orders who are young, the people who believe in values. They know what's right and wrong. They're young, and they're giving orders to the older people who are running the world. Do you see how it works? That's basically the late 60s. Hell no, I won't go, you know? And then you've got the older generation believing that as a nation, we need to have all of this community. We need to have all these long-term obligations. And you have a young generation just saying this, right? And you actually saw that evidence of that during the pandemic. Interestingly, as people did remark on that a little bit. The generation, the youth generation was the most likely to want to actually follow the rules. You know, like put on face masks and actually, you know, follow the rules when it comes to controlling the pandemic, even though they were by far the least at risk, right? The older generation, most at risk, were the ones who railed against all these regulations, right? And the reason why I bring that up is that if you had gone back to the 1970s, let's imagine we had had a pandemic, you know, like, I don't know, 1972, would have been the opposite. You would have older people saying, okay, let's get on our uniforms now. It's time to go to work. And younger people would have been saying, hell no, what are you talking about?
And the key thing here, just to make this super clear, because this is the perfect setup in the sense that imagine Richard Nixon's government America telling baby boomers to do X, Y, and Z versus even the millennial generation. Donald Trump is president. And they're still doing the thing.
Donald Trump, even as president, is still an outsider. He's railing against his own administration. It's still the deep state. It's still their enemies everywhere, even within his own organization. One of the fascinating things about Donald Trump is he was never really in charge. You know, I mean, even as president, his own government was almost his opponent, right? The problem with Donald Trump as being a populist is it's very hard for him to be in charge of anything because that means he's responsible. So he constantly has to rail against, you know, federal bureaucracies or Congress or people forcing me to do this and that, right? And I think the idea of being in charge and feeling responsible for what happens is not really in the boomer's DNA. Remember, their whole
interesting.
But the boomers' whole mission was to change the culture. It was not to build infrastructure, design a new constitution. It was to free your mind instead. You remember the old Beatles White Album, right? Free your mind, right?
Boomers. Not to be aggressive, but does this explain why boomers are obsessed with conspiracy theories? In the sense that, like, you know, think of, not to get overly political, but like RFK Jr., right? Like RFK Jr. seems to be incapable of, but I could see the attraction. If you are constitutionally incapable of being in charge, conspiracy theories and this and that seems
always
to be
out there.
It's a logical thing.
Right. You just always want to keep people inflamed and, you know, mobilized almost in a chaotic fashion to mobilize them with a purpose to actually change the world, well, then you have to take responsibility for it, right? It's interesting that boomers are aware of the charge that millennials often level against them, that, you know, they're a do as I say, not as I do generation, right? And, you know, boomers are always talking about high values. Where Bill Clinton came to the president saying you're really the most ethical presidency in American history. And you look at even conservatives, the CPAC doctrine is, you know, culture is upstream from politics. Whenever you look at boomers, right, culture has always come first and actual policies come later. Its intentions come first, right? That's that old awakening fire, right? The pure heart comes first and the inside comes first. And if that's pure, everything else follows, right? But being responsible for consequences, which is what follows, is something boomers have a hard time with. And when they're faced with these accusations that they don't really take charge and are really responsible for how they run these institutions, I think boomers' response is, we never really tried to run the institutions. Our whole purpose in life has been to change aspirations and ideals. Here's an interesting way to look at it. A phrase came into being, hugely increasing in popularity through the 1950s, as the GI generation was gaining power, kind of taking over America as the CEOs, and then ultimately by the end of the decade as president, right, with JFK. And that was coined by C. Wright Mills, who was called the power elite, you know, and the GI generation loved that, power elite. Yeah, we're the power, we're taking over, we got longer strides, you know, Kennedy said, we're going to take power, we're going to actually change. And then LBJ came with the Civil Rights Act, and you came up with that, we're going to put a man on the moon, and we were a nation that was just going to do huge things, the Great Society. And we really did, you know, do big things during that period. Another phrase became very popular, skyrocketing popularity during the 1990s when boomers were taking over. It wasn't the power elite, and it was coined by, I think, Newsweek magazine. It was a phrase called the cultural elite. Mm. That says it all, doesn't it? The power elite, the cultural elite. Boomers have always been fixated on the culture, and what they were going to do is they were going to be in charge of the culture. They were going to change the culture, because if you change the culture, everything else will eventually automatically follow. And in fact, in a long-term sense, they're right, because they lead America straight into the fourth turning and it'll lead up to millennials to actually change the world. So in some long-term sense, there's wisdom to that, but obviously boomers are not a generation which has taken responsibility either as CEOs or as political leaders for what they've done. I mean, all these mark-to-market buyout schemes and all these incredible things that boomers do, which are so obviously self-serving, and their lack of a long-term time horizon. But given how they came of age, celebrating the present, celebrating Live for Today, title of a famous song, by the way, why would we expect them to have a long-term orientation when it comes to how they actually manage their lives? Where boomers will become very interesting, I think, is when all we know about them is their values, because their values are actually very demanding and very unforgiving. And when you look at just the boomer values themselves, truth versus falsehood, good versus evil, and you have a younger generation of doers actuating those, then suddenly you have a society that can really move. That's why it really matters where boomers are in their phase of life. And I think one thing that's a little bit counterintuitive about our book is that we claim that boomers, when they finally completely in old age, will not be the pro-consumption lobby that we associate with AARP and senior citizens. That boomers will go along with sacrifice for everyone in America, much as earlier prophet archetypes have done in their old age, been in favor of individual sacrificing and behavior in favor of the community and in favor of younger people. And that will be a very surprising feature of the late fourth turning that we are going to see And in fact, I already see it. If you interview most boomers, you know, about Social Security and Medicare, yeah, they'll say, yeah, I don't want those things changed, but their heart isn't in it. I mean, they know that they didn't, you know, they didn't
earn it in the same way the GI generation did.
Exactly. They were never senior citizens. They weren't, you know, they didn't do any of that stuff. And they, I've been involved in looking at this for a long time. I was writing books about, you know, the generational inequity in the federal budget, even back in the 1980s. And I remember how the GI generation looked at it. It was, I paid my dues, you know, I splashed a sewer at Normandy, at Okinawa, at Tarawa, you know, and
that's a good argument too. That's the dynamic.
I built this country, kid, and I want my dues back. I mean, everything you see around you, we built, and you guys are just playing with it, right? And there was no response to that argument. And basically what happened in the 1970s, when the entire Vietnam fiscal dividend went to seniors. Now, that was after we expanded eligibility for Social Security. We put it on COLAs. We did a whole bunch of things to hugely shift the budget during that period to seniors. Boomers went along with that. Boomers did not object at all to bearing a much bigger fiscal burden for the GI generation turned senior citizen. Interesting, isn't it, that the same generation that we called junior citizens during World War II was the first generation of seniors to be called senior citizens in the late 60s, right? In other words, that same image just aged with them. Well, no one is going to cut benefits to senior citizens, right? Mm-hmm. And so there was a trade. What happened was is that the trade was this. Okay, you got Nixon and Watergate, new generation, really, no one cares about you anymore. So we're going to do this. You're going to get all your benefits. We're going to pile them on. You're going to let us have the culture. And that's what happened in the mid-70s. Until by the time Reagan came into the White House, we were playing Beach Boys. That was a big thing. I know it's hard for you to understand that, but that was actually a big thing, right?
Yeah.
Beach Boys at the White House. Whoa. Well, that was Nancy Reagan's. He told Ronnie that was okay. Now you can play Beach Boys. Ronald Reagan was okay with that. But my point is the boomers took over the culture, and that was the exchange. You give us the culture, let us do what we want in the culture. You guys get your benefits. As we move further into the fourth turning, the exchange is going to be the reverse. So the reverse is that the boomers will say, we're going to give up our benefits. This is a time of hardship. I mean, imagine what we would do in this country if we suddenly had to truly mobilize for some national emergency. We're going to give up those benefits. But in return, we're going to ask more from young people culturally, right? They're going to have to serve their country, right? That's going to be the difference. And that's going to be actually a huge slingshot for the millennial generation, right? Because that will empower them then to remake the world.
I want to ask one last quick question because I know we're hitting your time limit here. The New York Times did a good write-up last week about your book and how it's actually pervaded into pop culture. But the thing that I really actually kind of objected to in the narrative level was that, and by the way, this is the writer doesn't choose the headlines, but it referred to your work as like a doomsday theory. And I just kind of want to say, like, honestly, this doesn't feel doomsday-y. This feels very empowering. If I'm a millennial, in the sense that, like, it may feel like you're totally alone right now, but actually, like, your cohort members, you guys can do big things again. So I just want you to respond to whether or not this is a pessimistic or, I think this feels pessimistic against the 90s, but I think now that we're into it, this feels optimistic to me.
I think it is optimistic. First of all, I'm incredibly optimistic about America. I mean, I really believe in America. I believe in this country. And I think actually the fourth turning is a solution, you know, more than it is a problem. It's a huge challenge, and it will demand the most from all of us. But long term, it is a solution. It's a way to solve all of the problems that we now think of as insoluble. And it's a way to empower the younger generation again. I think. In other words, I'm very positive about where this nation comes out of the fourth turning. And you were right in what you said. writers do not choose the headlines, as you well know. And I've had many examples of op-eds, and I and just wince when I see the headline. Oh, God, they didn't say that, you know. And this is something that all viewers should understand. When you write something for a newspaper, like an op-ed, the editors insist on being able to choose a headline for you, which may completely misconstrue what it is. And the fact is that the writer of that article, which is actually interesting, it was a style section piece in the New York Times, did not say that in his article.
Yeah.
But, you know, the New York Times, you want to put it in a safe box. Oh, this is that. You know what I mean? It's a doomsayer. It's obviously not a doomsayer thing to anyone who's read the book.
Yeah, and so my closing thought is, and this, I think, once again, to your point, it's not optimistic. It's not pessimistic because it's a solution. You read a book about, you know, you read these like hagiographic books about what went wrong in the 2000s, and they say things like, how did we not come together after September 11th? We had all this opportunity. Why did George W. Bush tell us to go shopping instead of do national service? This book explains
why
that was the thing.
Yeah,
we don't have to think that this is all crazy. Like, yeah, this is a solution to that.
It does explain why. And that's a precursor event, as you said, and that's typical of precursor. It's kind of like World War I, or it's like the Mexican-American War. I will say this, that in one way, I think it's very positive, is that the book gives a really interesting and important role for each of today's generations, you know, over the next 15 years. And that is boomers to suddenly become, they fulfill their purpose as a generation of vision and values in a good way, right? Not necessarily with managing institutions, which they don't do very well, but to be that kind of elder cultural arbiter and providing kind of a guidepost for younger generations. It's a way for Gen X to suddenly see themselves not as terminal losers. I mean, this was a generation that was castigated and criticized ever since they were kids. I mean, we've never had a generation so heavily dumped with negativity by the media ever since they were born, even as kids. These were the Child's Devil horror movie kids, you remember? And the worst educated kids in American history. I mean, everything about Gen X is sort of, you know, garbagey, worthless, end of history, you know, nothing to them, nothing to contribute. And I think by contrast, Gen Xers will be at the fulcrum as midlife leaders in what happens. They will make the difference, right, as midlife leaders, for better or for worse. And then for millennials, this is a launching pad. Right. This is a launching pad for the rest of their lives. And whatever is created will be identified with them, much as the Republican generation, you know, who largely, you know, wrote the Federalist Papers, wrote the Constitution, right, is associated with them. I mean, this patriotic Republican generation, they were the ones who were elevated by this event, and they were able to create something long term for this country's future. This is empowering every generation alive today in a very special way, either because it helps them realize a better future, or it allows them to bring to bear a better side of themselves in this period to come than is necessarily what they've been contributing in the past.
That is an excellent place to leave it. Neil, this has been really great. Once again, I recommend all of your books, and I hope folks continue to dive into it. Thanks for joining me on The Realignment.
Great. Thank you, Marsh. It's been a pleasure.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.